Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio's Spoken Heard. I am Susan Dolby Chase, and today I am thrilled to bring you Mr. Stephen Willis. Hello,
hello.
How are you?
Good. I'm happy we can do this. I'm excited.
Yes, me too. Very excited. I have been following you, and I'm just a really big fan of your work, so I needed to let you know that right out of the gate here. And I'm hoping that we can do a little talking about some of your work and talking
sure.
a little bit about you as a person as well, because you're very interesting and I love what you're doing. So what's going on with you lately?
Well, lately, you know, we just returned back from Decatur, Georgia for the National
mm-hmm.
Poetry Slam. And this year
I was
on the Brooklyn Slam team, which was the first Brooklyn team that we've had in 10 years here in New
wow.
York. You know, we're known for, you know, the New Eurekan Poets Cafe and very historic
yes.
venues like Urbana and Bowery. But there was a Brooklyn team about in 2006, and there was a resurgence of it this year, thanks to Mahogany L. Brown and Jive Poetic and Brick, a community center located here in downtown Brooklyn. And it just was truly, truly an honor to be with that team and work with some of the
mm-hmm.
best poets in spoken word. So we're fresh
yes.
off that. A little debriefing had to happen immediately afterwards. It can be very tolling and taxing doing all those
mm-hmm.
poems and festering up all those emotions. But I'm happy to be back and definitely happy to be on the show.
Well, excellent. And I know that you did well personally and as a team in Decatur, so I want to congratulate you for that, because honestly, in the first resurgent year, you made a name for yourselves, and I'm really very happy that that you were able to do that. I was wondering,
definitely.
Steve, if I could. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to step on
no,
you.
No, sure. Go ahead.
Okay, I was wondering if I could prevail upon you to share one of your poems with us.
Sure. I would love to. I'll probably share one of the most important pieces, and we'll talk about it a little bit later on the show, about how this piece particularly changed my life. It's probably my most famous piece. It's the piece that I have up on Button, and it is a piece that is very close to me, for it encompasses really what was a very tumultuous year, my first year of slam here in New York poetry. And it's a piece called Ebonics 101. Perhaps I should start this interview by informing you that I am bilingual, that the Queen's English that I speak so eloquently before you now is not my first language, no. My grandmother never used such diction when she spoke me up in the welfare line amongst the other dwellers. Or when she called down to me from the project window for dinner, no, we spoke a more southern fried English. This rhetorical recipe has been in my family for generations, Grandma said. Big Mama hid it under her tongue when she headed for northern cities during the Great Migration. Scholars call it African-American vernacular English, but my guys, they call it slang. The man calls it Ebonics. I call it America's Creole. The last remaining squad burst from a European and African pigeon turned into the dialect of the doughboy. The bass that appears in a rapper's rhythmic rhetoric spoken everywhere from the trap house to the liquor store, from the HIV testing clinic to the bus stop. Ebonics is the official language of the undefined black culture, the native tongue to the underrepresented black American. And long before I received liberal arts degrees and stood unopposing in academic settings, I was born on the south side of Chicago and managed to garner up enough street cred from the School of Hard Knocks to qualify me to teach you all a few of my language's essentials. So, hipsters, I hope you have your notepads ready, because this is Ebonics 101. Chapter 1. any English word that holds an I-N combination, the I becomes an A. Like Billie Holiday couldn't sing, that girl could sing. If Martin did all that walking, I wonder if him feet stank, traveled all the miles just to hear freedom ring. I wonder what he was thinking. Chapter 2. Any English word that holds an O-R combination with an R sound becomes silent. Like Emmett screaming, don't beat me no more. Like Rodney screaming, don't beat me no more. Like Trayvon asking, what is you following me for? Chapter 3. Any English word that holds an E-R combination with an E-R becomes an A. Like in the great quote from the linguistic scholar, Miss Lauren Hill. And even after all my logic and my theory, I add a MF or so you ignorant niggas hear me. See, there's culture in these words. The bended back of my speech comes from years of carrying the black experience. The verbal diaspora of Africa shapes our spine. We cross our T's like the middle passage, dot our I's with strange fruits, curve our essence with mid-Atlantic roots. You cannot expect us to be slaves to your phonetics forever. And just like our history, we would defy the structure of your Jim Crow grammar, refuse to speak within the lines of your Mason-Dixon diction. You cannot correct this, context this, connotate my accomplishments. See me be black male. Use double negative to make positive. He will write into the black story no longer persists. He will write into the clenched pen is synonymous with a clenched fist. He will write into the black male is able to live, be, exist. Class dismissed.
I love it. I really, really love it. And, you know, how you broke down the linguistics kind of, you know, really as an academic kind of overview and then went into the vernacular in order to provide background, but also to highlight different social problems, social settings, social awareness, I guess.
Yeah.
So you were mentioning that this is a really, really important poem to you. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, sure. You know, I got my start in spoken word through slam. Of course, I began slamming when I was 15 years old in Chicago. I'm born and raised in Chicago, Illinois. And I went to Morgan Park High School on the south side of the city, in the Hunnets, as we call it. And I started doing Louder Than a Bomb at 15 and really, really fell in love with spoken word. Stopped doing it for a little bit once I went to college and found myself coming right back to it. And that first year that I spent, you know, from 2013 to 2014, from August 2013 to about November 2014, I lost every single slam I did in New York City. And I'm talking everywhere. I'm talking the New Yorican Poets Cafe, Urbana, Mike Geffner's Inspired Word, Louder Arts was existing at that time still. Like, I lost every single slam I possibly did. And I began to learn the very different kicks and, you know, trinkets that come with doing spoken word, particularly in New York City, where slam is cash crop. You know, in Chicago, though it being the home of slam poetry, and Mark Smith is still there, runs the Uptown Poetry Slam at the Green Mill, it's more of a performative element, an entertainment element. It doesn't really have the sort of kind of very rigorous slam culture that exists here in New York. And Ebonics 101 was the piece that I wrote after first. It's finally clicking, you know, of what slam could be and what I could be in slam and what exactly it entails, how to have very strong political conversation, how to combine that and mix that in very intentional distinctions in your writing. You know, it was very intentional to make the decision to want to put the poem in a school setting. You know, I was in college at the time and saw how quickly students would just swallow things once the teacher said it, never really questioning it. And it was also at a very tumultuous time in 2013, 2014, and even till now, where police brutality was a big thing, and the conversation of race was there. And I wanted to find a way of how can we discuss race without actually saying it. You know, how can I show you an element of the black experience in a way that was different? And I decided to do it through language and linguistics. And, you know, blacks are well known for the quote-unquote code switch. You know, there's so many different things that help embody, and Ebonics 101 and embody so much of who I am as a person.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that you were listened to more in college as well when you did the code switching?
You know what? I would say so. I would say so. And it sort of became a certain element of protest to even not code switch in a moment. You know, I am very intrigued in individuals' everyday lives and how they are able to protest in their everyday life. Like, what is a decision that you can make today that in itself is a sign of protest? You know, when we think about the huge Islamophobia that happens in this world now, you know, for a woman to step outside in her hijab, that is a protest. That is making that despite the political climate of this country, I am still going to stay true to myself, to my culture, you know, and to my religion. You know, and for a lot of my life, I spent a lot of my life policing myself as an African-American male. You know, there, you know, in a lot of my photos, my headshots, you'll see I have a hat on, you know, or wear a hat often.
Right.
The big reason of why that is because majority of my life I was afraid to wear one, afraid of being connected to a gang and being seen that way as a gangster. Mm-hmm. You know, in Chicago, you wear your hat to a certain side. That could be a sign of affiliation, you know, and so now when I step into an academic setting or a poetry event and wear that hat backwards, you know, that in itself was something I would never do in fear of being truncated into this image of what black male masculinity was or wasn't, or the stigmas of people that come from my city, that come from the side of my city. And so definitely having these particular conversations in academic setting and not deciding not to code switch or deciding not to change the rhetoric or, you know, the Ebonics twang is definitely a sign of protest every time I do it.
Well, I love that, and I love your explanation of it, and I respect so much saying in the poem and what you just explained so much. I really, you know, when people do that element of protest every day, when there's a small way of influencing the world, I think that those small things really add up to very large things. And people sometimes don't see that aspect of their life influencing the larger world, but it's true. It's really true that sometimes big things start small. In fact, that's the way all big things start.
Of course. I always want to debunk the myth that the only form of protest is on the front line. You know, we as artists are, you know, what we decide to as artists to put our name to, the particular political statements that we make in our work are signs of protest, are pushing the world and pushing the art form forward. Not all of us are going to be able to be on the front lines. You know, not all of us are going to be able to be at every rally. But what we can do is rally behind an idea and rally behind a certain element of thought and make sure that we continue to push that in the world in any way that we possibly can, whether it be in the clothing we choose to wear or in the art that we choose to make.
Now, did these ideas come directly from you, or were you influenced by other people who started speaking to this kind of social, social rebellion? Did people influence you through their discussion of these things, or were you just an amazing young man who was able to think these completely originally on your own?
Yeah, well, I think that's a great question. And I would say the first inception of this form of thought came from, rest in peace, an organizer and educator out of Chicago by the name of Brother Mike Hawkins, who is responsible for what I like to call the Chicago Millennial Renaissance that is happening out of Chicago right now. I don't think there is a significant contributor to any form of art, whether it be visual art, whether it be music, whether it be poetry, no significant contributor of the millennial age coming out of Chicago right now was not influenced by Mike Hawkins. You know, myself, activists and poets like Malcolm London, well-known rapper, Chance the Rapper, all of us were under the wing of Mike Hawkins, who openly taught us that it was important to have a responsibility in your art, right? Art and responsibility. You know, so many people do art as a form of expression and as a form of fun, which it definitely can be. But he taught us very early the responsibility that we have to our communities, that we ultimately want to support our art, right? We always talk about, hey, support the arts, but what exactly are you infiltrating back into the community with your newfound celebrity, or whether it be exactly what it is that you're talking about? And I think from there, always stuck with me, that idea, and then continuing to push that forward through my college years, having teachers like Maureen Kindlin at Manhattanville who would teach us the importance of community and community building. Right. And then moving on to working with people like Mahogany L. Brown and Jive Poetic, who do nothing but reiterate things that I've already been taught in my youth, and helping me find new ways on how to express that in my work.
What wonderful living monuments to change those two authors are. So shout out to them. They're wonderful. And I've had the opportunity to sit through classes with Mahogany L. Brown, and she just makes me think so much. I go away and I come back to it, and I go away and I come back to it. And every time that I think of what she says, I tend to grow a little bit. So I really respect those authors as well. Yeah.
For sure. Mahogany, definitely. I always like to joke that she likes to put these little mental bombs on me. You know, she'll ask me a question. You know, she'll ask me a question. She'll say something randomly like, you know, what is a good poem? And it's like, what does that even mean, right? And I would come with my very long-winded liberal arts answer. And Mahogany will come and respond and say, a good poem has a clear topic and a clear voice. And then that's all she'll say. That's it. The conversation's over, right? And so the rest of my life, I'm sitting there trying to figure out, does my poem have a clear topic? Does my poem have a clear voice, right? And, you know, it's just those small moments. You know, mentorship happens in the small moments. You know, it's not, you know, these big extravagant things that happens. It's the, you know, little small things they say. My mother is very similar. You know, I come from a very Christian background, very conservative background, for the most part at least. And, you know, my mother would say little things to me like, you know, what you're doing is right, but is it righteous? You know, and then just walk away. Like, thanks, Mom. You know, what does that mean? You know, always,
what does that even mean? Yeah.
You know, we're always balancing the world of what is the carnal world view as right, you know, or morale.
Right.
You know, and then what would your own moral standings, religious standings tell you is the righteous things to do? And you will often find that you conflict with those things, and forcing me as a young person coming up in the world to reconcile that and decide what kind of person I want to be.
Could I ask you, we're more than halfway through the show already. It's just flying by. There's so many good things to talk about. I would love to hear another poem, though, if I could.
Sure. I'm going to do a poem that it's a one of my older poems, but it's definitely one that I love to do. I'm inspired because it's a part of my Brooklyn culture now. Now I've been living in Brooklyn for a year, and it's called Bobby. If I can remember how it starts. See? Look at that. Let's see. Saying that Bobby Shmurda created the two-step, now being dubbed the Shmoney Dance, It's like saying Columbus discovered America. No. This has been here long before you were. The tribal dance of the black American. Most common after Luther saying never too much. Or after Auntie has had too many. For the first and for the fourth, I've seen black skin. Rain dance the rain away from cookouts and reunions. I learned here that there was not a God, neither Roman nor Greek, that would test the likes of this black magic. For hell has no fury like Big Mama's sweat. The nerve of those wide sagazzo hips to move like seaweed in the ocean-stained rhythm blue. The audacity of a steady snap to put a four count on freedom as proof that our history's greatest ability is choreography. And we've been sequencing these steps in slavery, synchronizing the offbeat to the sound of oppression to win. Black folk known for their innovation, like the way we use the electricity from our slides to power our robots. Inhale. As the only people in history to ever break dance only to pop lock it back together, who kept Harlem shaking long after the Renaissance and considered it more than a constellation, to watch Michael Jackson moonwalk his way into pop stardom, taking one small step as a man, but one giant step for our kind, so that one day our first lady could dub you with our children, and that little black boys and little black girls could no longer be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their crip walk. So this is for everyone, from the cotton fields to the cotton club, from the hip-hop tapper to the jazz twerker, from the time that the jitterbug has morphed into the worm, nothing has come easy for us cakewalkers. So Bobby didn't create this. He inherited it from a wino great uncle of Georgia who rode the soul train line north to Chicago and saw his mother had a bop in the living room. Before you were even formed in your mother's womb, this two-step knew you, set you apart, declared you as a prophet to give name to the oldest black heirloom of motion. So come join me, join me, join me in the coronation of this chain link shuffle, this strange fruit-inspired swing, this disco disposition. Come watch this southern black body migrate to a northern soul. This be that jiggaboo boogie. This be that Jim Crow jig. This be that plantation plan. Be much more than your appropriation, much more than your dance craze, much more than your vine. Reloop, be our truth, be our roots, be our body. Just a week ago.
I love your use of certainly your message, but your use of cadence in this poem, in the oral presentation of it, is just almost mesmerizing in effect. And your references, your analogies, your the way that you mention things without mentioning them, like Martin Luther King Jr., et cetera. I find those things really, really very interesting and very deep. Is there a way that you went about cultivating that kind of thing in your own work?
That's a great question. And it actually sort of kind of leads me into the album that I will be releasing. I will be releasing a new album in October. October 15th will be the official release date of my new album, called Culture, and it is based off a conversation I overheard while I used to go to Manhattanville College. And so when I graduated from Manhattanville College, it's my alma mater, I shouldn't say I used to go to, but I used to take the Metro North to and from Westchester when I used to try to slam at the New Yorican back when I was in college. And one day when coming back from the New Yorican, I overheard a conversation between two gentlemen. They were two Haitian gentlemen, and they were having a conversation about African-Americans. And what I mean by I mean actual African-Americans, individuals who were only connection to the black diaspora is that of American slavery. So, not Jamaican, not Haitian, not necessarily black America, but African-American. And his statement was that his premise overall was that African Americans lacked a culture. And this lack of culture was one of the reasons why there were so many things plaguing the African American community, that a culture is what provides you with your element of esteem, that your culture is what provides you with your element of direction. You know, if all else fails, you just follow the elements of your culture. And this is why African Americans are so seemingly flippant and so seemingly undereducated. And I was overhearing this conversation, and, you know, as offensive as it wasn't the first time I had heard such a thing. I hear it all the time in my own community. And so from that moment, I made a decision that I would identify what African American culture was in my work. And so when you see poems like Ebonics, it has a very intentional element in the culture. It is language. Or you see poems like Bobby, it's dance. Or if you see poems like my poem Dylan, it's religion. You know, there's other poems that I'm working on that fit directly into these elements of what culture is. And so I talk about a lot in my work, Dr. King, or I'm referencing the Middle Passage, or I'm referencing, you know, just other elements of what happened in African-American history. It's in those small, intricate ways of giving you what the African-American history and what African-American culture is, where its roots lie, without openly saying that. And so this album, Culture, that's coming out in October, is that. It is all of the poems connected into the culture set of dance, music, art, child rearing, all these different things for us to understand African-American culture better and to prove that that man who I heard on the train, prove him wrong. And he has truly defined the rest of my life. In my art.
Interesting that just overhearing conversations can do that. And I want to, before we move on from it, where might people be able to get this in October?
Well, I will be competing in the Individual World Poetry Slam, which is going to be in Flagstaff, Arizona this year. And my hope is to release it the same day as finals. But you can always find it on my SoundCloud. My SoundCloud is soundcloud.com/hisairnesspoetry. I am His Airness on all social media. His Airness is spelled HISHEIRNESS. His Airness, it's based off today. Today is August 28th. This is the 53rd anniversary. 53rd anniversary of the March on Washington. For jobs and freedom that happened in 1963, of course, famously known for the Martin Luther King I Have a Dream speech. And it was on this day in 2013 that I first started my chance of trying to do 100 shows in a year, which I am currently doing now.
Yeah.
I'm trying to do 100 different venues in a year. I know you guys see that on my social media. So in 2013, that's when I first got into slam poetry. So this day is very important, which is why I chose today to do the interview with you, because of the history of today, the history not only for my people, but the history for my personal self inside of spoken word. So you can find all my poems at His Airness Poetry on SoundCloud. I'm His Airness Poetry on Tumblr. I am His Airness on Twitter, His Airness on Instagram, His Airness on Snapchat. And you can find me there.
Excellent. I'm so glad to have those ways of getting in touch with you and also by being able to share your work with us. Is there any other merchandise or any venues or anything else that you would like to promote before we end the show? We're coming right up on the end, unfortunately.
No. We are coming up on, and just want to continue to promote BRIC. September 15th is the start of the new Brooklyn Slam Team season. So if anybody is interested in slamming there, that's the way to do it. It's 647 Fulton in downtown Brooklyn. So let's get BK 2017 team started off right on September 15th.
Excellent. And I'm so thrilled to have had you today. You're just amazing. And if at any point you would like to come back and discuss more, or you would like to promote the team and have them on with you, or you want to practice your poems for nationals, for individual world slam, just let me know, because really, honestly, you are one of the most articulate young men in the slam scene today, and I am so impressed with the way that you are able to explain the processes that you go through in your work, it's just amazing to me that you have so much behind it that's so cerebral at your age. Just amazing to me.
Thank
you
so much.
You're welcome.
And thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you for coming here today. Yes, yes. This is Susan Dobie Chase. This has been Spoken Heard. Next week, tune in at the same time. We'll have another incredible guest. And until then, be kind to one another.